Welcome to the Art of High Performance Living. I am your host, Iron Mike Stone. We speak with best-selling authors, business leaders, CEOs, entrepreneurs, and the pros that know. Hello, everybody out there. This is Iron Mike Stone, and today I am very pleased to introduce you to our guest, Professor Megan L. O'Sullivan. She is the Jean Kirkpatrick Professor of the Practice of International Affairs and the Director of the Geopolitics of Energy Project at Harvard University's Kennedy School. Her expertise includes the geopolitics of energy, American foreign policy, decision-making in foreign policy, nation-building, and the Middle East. Her third book, Windfall, is now out, and I have read it, and we're going to discuss it today. Professor, are you on the line?
I am. Good morning, and thanks for having me on the show.
Absolutely. I'm very excited to have you here. I think we've got perhaps a little bit different audience than you may be used to. Our audience is filled with business people, entrepreneurs, investors, and authors. And I think your book is a very important insight into the economics of energy and global politics. I think it's very insightful for those types of people to have an understanding of what's going on in the world, how energy is impacting it, and how it impacts their business and their lifestyle. I will say, as we get into this, I want to put right out in front that surprisingly maybe isn't the right word, but it is a very, very easy read, well-written, well-organized, and you can really pull a lot of information out of your book. So I'm looking forward to getting into that. But before we start, I want to go back and just learn a little bit about you. Tell me about where you grew up, kind of, you know, as a little girl, you've got a heck of a lot of accomplishments. I can't imagine growing up, did you aspire to be an advisor to presidents?
I grew up in Lexington, which is a town right outside of Boston. So I've kind of come full circle in coming back to Harvard. And I grew up in a family that wasn't particularly international. So my foreign policy focus is a little bit of a surprise to everyone. But I started reading this child's encyclopedia when I was young, and I was fascinated by all the tales of foreign countries. And so it got me interested in travel and different cultures. And so I kind of embarked on trying to have a career that took me into the world from a pretty young age.
Okay, well, that's pretty neat. So when you decided to go into college, when did you enter college as a study? Political science, economics?
Yes. Yep, I went to Georgetown because I was interested, again, in doing something international. And I studied politics and international affairs as well as economics. And Georgetown has a tradition of training people for the Foreign Service. And from there, when I graduated, I went overseas. And then I went to Indonesia. And then subsequently, I did my graduate work at Oxford University. And for, I don't know, maybe 15 years, I lived 10 years overseas. And then, you know, I'd come back and work a little bit in Washington. So the last 20 years or so, I've been overseas and in Washington and now up at Harvard. So I've had a chance to live in Asia and the Middle East and in Europe and then have I've been very fortunate to have an interesting career advising people in policy at the State Department, at the Defense Department, and at the White House, as you mentioned, for President Bush.
That's incredible. Let me just dig a little bit deeper on what you just said, because, again, you know, I think and you're used to it now, but you went to Georgetown and then you went overseas, and it's easy to just kind of like recite that as a resume, but that had to be scary. When you were a young girl, recent college graduate, I mean, what did it feel like to be off into new worlds was it intimidating? Did you ever doubt yourself, or did you always have confidence that this is where you're going and you're gonna make it through there? Tell me a little bit about that.
No, I would say probably one of the hardest years, especially around that time, was right after I graduated from college. I I received a fantastic fellowship to go live in Asia. I'd never been to Asia. I had only been to Europe. And I went and was working for an NGO in Indonesia. And I was 21, and I
wow.
didn't know a single person in that hemisphere. And this was
wow.
in 1991. And if you remember, in 1991, there was no email. There
right.
was no, you know, cell phones. And so it took 6 weeks to get a letter from home where
yep.
I was living.
When you were gone, were really gone back then. Yeah,
I was really gone. And in retrospect, I'm really glad that I was able to experience what it felt like to really be alone. But I realized that, you know, most people won't have to feel that way anymore because we have so much connectivity. But it was a tough year because I always say I have an adventurous spirit and a weak constitution. So I got, you know, I had typhoid, I had salmonella, I had dengue fever. So I really had Asian tropical island experience. But so it was a tough year. It was definitely a tough year. But as you know, your question implied, I learned a lot about myself. And certainly it made me feel confident to go into environments that were unknown. And I did that a lot in my career subsequently. And probably the most challenging one is the 2 years that I spent in Iraq. And
yeah.
you know, especially in those beginning days in Iraq, there was so much uncertainty and insecurity.
Yeah, what years
and,
were you there in Iraq? What years?
I went in with the first civilian convoy in 2003, a few days after Saddam left Baghdad.
Yeah,
so that was
wow.
2003.
Yeah.
And I spent about not quite a year and a half there at that time. And then I went back for 3 month stints again in 2007 and 2008, working on different policy things for the U.S. government, working with the Iraqi government. So, you know, I saw it at the very beginning and then some of the darkest days. And then, you know, when it started to turn around after the surge. So it's a place that's near and dear to my heart.
Well, I got to tell you, your courage on that is tremendous because, again, you know, I mean, 21 years old going to Asia. And like you said, and we forget about what that time was like when we weren't all connected, you know, easily by the internet and communications, and you're off in Asia. And then later you're going off to Iraq during the war time in a very turbulent period of time. That, you know, you can read somebody's resume, but when you really dig in a little bit and you start to think about it, and it's the same with a lot of my audience when whatever they're going to try to accomplish, be it trying to, you know, take a project on as writing a new book or open up a new
yep.
business, perhaps leave the safety of a paycheck and a career to step into the unknown world of opening your own thing. You know, there's those moments that we all have of, you know, it's more than doubt. It's a little bit of fear, but you know,
right.
kind of, you know,
right.
to your credit, you get through those and it makes you stronger and better. And I imagine you know, it's kind of why you were able to go into Iraq because you had a whole history of, you know, I was a swimmer in high school and a diver. And I like to always say you step up to the high diving board. And those are the moments when you're about to go, you know, off the board. You know, that's the pinnacle of living. So I give you a lot of congratulations on that. And
on a high diving board.
Yeah.
I'll go to Iraq, but I won't dive off that high diving board. But no, I think that's at the core of being an entrepreneur, as your show, you know, suggests, is being able to deal and be productive in a situation of uncertainty. And I think that is one of the things that my travels taught me is
yep.
how to, you know, get things done in an environment where there are a lot of unknowns. And, you know, I call myself sometimes an entrepreneurial policy person, but maybe not an entrepreneur in the sense of many of your listeners. But I do think that's a commonality.
Well, I think it's a commonality. And we consider entrepreneurship to be a lifestyle and a spirit. And, you know, it's not just
yep.
your career or your job. So you definitely embody
right.
it. And that's why I was very excited to have you on as a guest today. Let me
Thank
jump
you.
Into... couple of your career positions, and I know you have a very terrific resume there, but I'm very, very interested in your time spent as a security advisor to the President of the United States, George W. Bush. How old were you when you got that job? And just give me a little insight on what's it like working in the White House, working with the President, particularly during that time with the Iraq War, if there was ever a time of tension and pressure. Give us a little,
yeah.
What was it like on that?
Sure. I mean, it was an amazing privilege to work for President Bush and to be part of that historical moment. So my portfolio was Iraq and Afghanistan, and this was in 2004 until end of 2007, and again in part of 2008. So very intense period for our country. And I was young for the job, but I had spent all this time in Iraq beforehand. So I went to Iraq. I had worked in the State Department before that for Secretary Powell. And then I volunteered to go to Iraq, was in Iraq about a year and a half, and then went to the White House. And at the time, you know, I think part of the reason I had that opportunity was because I had gotten to know the Iraqis very, very well. And at the White House, a lot of what needed to be done was trying to work with them, trying to negotiate with them, trying to figure out how to get a political solution to the conflict that was there. So working for President Bush was fantastic. It was a really hard job, as you can imagine, because there was not a frivolous moment or, you know, a day that didn't bring you know, something surprising. And in those days, usually the surprises were not good ones. But he was a great person to work for because he was very consistent with what he wanted to achieve. He really had a vision and he was all about principles. And again, in that period, there was so much domestic pressure to withdraw from Iraq. And he really wanted to do what he thought was right for our country and for the commitments we had made rather than what was popular at the time. So I worked with him and others in the government, of course, at the time that we were revising our strategy. And we came up with a new strategy called the Surge. And that was a period in 2007 where the president, at a time when everybody, Democrats and most Republicans, were telling him to withdraw from Iraq, he decided to send more troops to Iraq. And we changed our strategy, and it actually paid off. It really brought about
a remarkable improvement.
It was,
I remember that well.
And it just took so much courage for a leader to make that decision in the face of so much, you know, guaranteed opposition. And so I learned a lot from that experience. And, you know, again, people think when you work in the White House, it's all about Air Force One and the Rose Garden and the Oval Office. And there's some of that, but there's a lot of really hard work and working with colleagues and trying to figure out how to respond to problems. And occasionally you're lucky enough to try to take advantage of an opportunity.
I imagine that's not a 9-to-5 type position. It's on call 24 hours a day, I would assume, huh?
Yeah, it's definitely not 9-to-5. I think I would go in around 6 o'clock in the morning because President Bush would be in the office at 7 and he wanted to read, you know, everything that you could in case he had a question for you at 7. And he often did have a question for me because he would read about Iraq and Afghanistan first thing in the morning. And then, you know, if I got home by midnight, it was a really good day. It often was later than that. And I worked, I think, almost every weekend that I was at the White House for those years. So, yeah, it definitely there wasn't a lot of time for other activities. It really became, you know, it's your entire life when you're working there.
All encompassing, yeah.
For me, I felt that was appropriate. You know, there were lots of people who made, you know, huge sacrifices, including their lives for these wars.
Right.
And so, you know, there was no commitment on my part that seemed too large.
Yep. Fascinating. I want to get to your book, but I got one other thing I want to talk about also that I think is amazing. And I just want a little insight for our listeners is, so after the State Department and the advising, you became a professor at Harvard University, which arguably is one of the finest universities in the country. Tell me about that.
Well,
that's pretty amazing.
Well, I won't take issue with your arguably. But, no, it's a wonderful place. I actually grew up very close to Harvard, but I never really thought about it because I was interested in going far away when I went to college. So it never came into my consideration. But it's a place where I have had the pleasure of basically training people. I work at the Kennedy School, which is our school for government and public service. So mm-hmm. I teach students who are interested in going into government or nonprofits, or some of them go into businesses, but all of them are very public service oriented. So they're all interested in making the world a better place. And what I love about the university and the Kennedy School is that's everybody's mission. So you don't have to be embarrassed if that's your goal. You know, you want to change the world, you want to make it better, you're in the right place. And being surrounded by people who feel that way and talk about that and gear their energies in that direction is such, you know, it's such a privilege because it keeps you optimistic. And I still consider myself young, but at some point I won't be, but hopefully I'll still feel young being surrounded right. by that spirit.
Yep, yep. Great spirit there. Absolutely fabulous. Well, let's get on and talk about the book. This is your third book, Windfall, How the Energy Abundance Upends Global Politics and Strengthens America's Power. And I mentioned it in the beginning. I got to tell you, I found it to be an amazing, easy read. It just seemed to flow, and it's given me a depth and a perspective on the energy market. And you know, not even currently, but, you know, the points you make just throughout history, how it's impacted, you know, geopolitical events all over the place. Just give the readers a little bit snippet of you know, the book, and I'll kind of dig into a few questions I have. But tell us a little bit just about the summary.
Sure. Well, first of all, the reason I wrote the book is because, you know, I've been in the world of foreign policy, and in the last 10 years, I've spent a lot of time in the world of energy. And I am surprised how few people inhabit both worlds, because I consider energy to be a big driver of foreign policy. You know, what happens in energy markets really spills over into how countries interact with one another. If you think about just the United States, what would America's relationship with the Middle East be if the Middle East didn't have oil? It would still be complicated and we'd be involved, but it would be totally different. You know, what about Russia's relationship with Europe? Energy is a huge driver. And so I believe that energy drives foreign policy. And when we see a big change in energy markets, we should expect that to affect politics. And that's basically what we've been seeing, but I felt like there wasn't enough appreciation of that overlap. So, you know, at the most basic level, I'm trying to encourage my reader to think about how important it is to understand energy markets if you want to understand what's going on in the world. You know, we focus a lot on North Korea and on Iran or Sunni Shia or a variety of things, but, you know, energy markets really permeate every relationship in some way. And so that's one of my big goals. My second goal would really be bringing attention to the big energy revolution that has happened in the United States. And there, it's a great story about an entrepreneurial spirit and how the shale revolution really came about, and that has transformed opportunities for the United States in not just economically, but also geopolitically. And so a big part of the book talks about that, talks about how these changes that began, you know, in Texas and from new technologies, not necessarily government policies, but from entrepreneurs, have had such an impact that it's affected global politics.
Yep. It's, you know, I mean, as an investor and a business guy, I'm well aware of, you know, the fracking and, mm-hmm. and all that, but I never actually took the time to sew that up with, you know, how that affects, you know, everything from, you know, the Middle East to China and Russia and the play on all that. And, you know, one question I have, and I think I read it in there, but are we now energy independent, I guess you would say, or are we not quite there?
Yeah, well, I mean, I think it depends on what definition you use, but most Americans think about energy independence as meaning that we're like in our own energy island. We don't need any other country or any other form of trade. And in that respect, we're not energy independent. And my book argues, nor should we try to become energy independent, because we don't need to be self-sufficient in that sort of isolated way, because that would be very costly. It would be inefficient. And what we really want to be is to have, you know, to have energy independence in the sense that, you know, to make sure that our foreign policy and national security is not driven by the desire or the need to import oil or gas or other energy sources from other countries. So we definitely have come closer to that, our imports have gone dramatically down, our imports of oil. So just say a little more than 10 years ago, we were importing about two-thirds of what we were consuming, if you look at net imports of oil. And today, that's more like 25%. I mean, it's a huge difference. And so that has brought, you know, a little bit more flexibility, a little bit more room to maneuver for the United States. But, you know, we need to be focused more on just making sure that global markets work well and less focused on, you know, can we get to a place where we're not interacting with any other country? Because that actually is, it's a misleading metric in terms of security.
Gotcha. It's kind of a pride in America kind of thing to think, oh, we're energy independent, but I understand about the dynamics and everything being interrelated. What about...
Well, and just let me give a quick example to make it real. So if we were energy independent in the sense of being self-sufficient, that would mean, you know, even in places close to the Mexican or Canadian border, that we wouldn't import or export energy there. Instead, we might send energy, you know, from Texas to, you know, Utah or something that doesn't make sense, or Washington State, when, you know, we can really just import or export right across the border because both of those countries are big energy producers. So it's a lot more efficient when you can just let the markets do the work rather than trying to direct everything.
Right. Gotcha. And you do in your book, you talk about the new technology that allowed for the fracking and kind of a different economic model. And again, that's something I pay a lot of attention to, is new technology. And the one thing about technology, it's constantly evolving and constantly changing. And, you know, now there's a lot of AI out there that's going to be used in, you know, finding oil and finding these wells. It just seems like the energy market and your world with the technology, it's right at the cutting edge of everything, really, when you get right down to it.
Well, and let me give you an example in terms of OPEC. So it's true that technology is the key in the story, I think, and the technology is getting better every day, which means that producers can produce more oil and gas for the same amount of money. You know, every day they can do more for cheaper. And so this affects global markets. And so OPEC, you know, the countries that have traditionally had a lot of influence on the oil market, have been really caught off guard because they keep imagining that if the price goes to a certain level, that Americans will stop producing this oil. But the technology keeps getting better, so we keep being able to produce more oil at a lower price. And so this has had a big impact on OPEC countries, and in fact making them less powerful and less able to really have an impact on global markets, something that I think most Americans would think would be a good thing.
Definitely. But at the same time, is there destabilization brought to those areas? I've been watching in recent times as princes that I used to see come on TV talking about their investments in the United States being thrown in jail over there. Is that?
Yeah. Well, I mean, without question that this gets into, and I address this in the book in some details, you know, that with the lower price of oil, that's meant some big changes for countries around the world. A lot of them are in the Gulf and the Middle East. Some of them are Nigeria, Venezuela, Russia. And these are countries that have really depended almost in some cases entirely on the revenue that they get from oil exports. So when the price, you know, went down dramatically from $110 a barrel to, say, at the beginning of 2016, it was under $30. They've had to revise their economic plans, and many of them are now worried about their ability to survive because they had put in place such complicated social models where people receive so many subsidies, so many freebies. That's not sustainable in this new oil environment. And so a lot of these countries, Saudi Arabia being maybe the most important, were working really hard to try to reform their economy. But it's still an open question whether they're going to be successful. I think it's really in our interest that they are, but I think we still don't know the answer to that question.
Yep. Well, I tell you what, fascinating world you live in and the dynamics that you're involved in. Thank you for sharing with us. I'm going to ask you kind of an off base question here, but again, one of the things that I like to get from all my guests, particularly the successful ones, which I guess are all of them, is any advice for some of our younger listeners, people out there, you know, finding their path in life and you know, just advice you can give them on their career path, on their life path, success, persistence, anything you, you would like to pass on.
Sure. I mean, I would say the thing that has made the biggest difference for me is pushing myself outside my comfort zone. So don't be afraid to put yourself in a position, not where you're paralyzed by fear or but, you know, where you're not comfortable. You know, you're a little bit beyond your comfort zone, and that's where a lot of the learning happens, and that's where a lot of the opportunities open up. So I definitely encourage people to do that as they're exploring their career and making plans. If someone is interested in a career in the world that, I worked in terms of government, the thing I would say that's most important is learn how to write well, because writing is kind of the key to communicating in government and in policy circles. And so I really think I look back and I'm grateful to the people who really drilled into me how to write quickly, concisely, and clearly, because that's the key to success in the policy world.
Well, excellent, excellent. Thank you for the advice. And where can people learn more about you? Where can they buy the book? Website, any place we can find you if we want more?
Sure, yeah. My personal website is www.osullivanmeghan, so it's O-S-U-L-L-I-V-A-N, and then Meghan, M-E-G-H-A-N.com, and there's a lot of stuff about me, but there's a page on the book, and I would love more readers and more feedback when people have the chance to look at it. So thanks for giving me the opportunity to talk about it.
Well, listen, excellent, and I can't recommend the book enough. Again, it's an easy read, and it's insightful. It's a perspective and a background that I think anybody in leadership or business or, you know, just a citizen of the United States really should take the perspective and take some time to understand. And with that, I'm going to let us go here. I thank you again, and best of luck to you.
Thank you very much, Mike. Have a good day.
Thanks for listening to The Art of High Performance Living. As your gift, I'll be happy to send you my best-selling book, Ignite Your Life. Co-authored by Brian Tracy and dozens of other leading entrepreneurs, sign up at imhighperformance.com or send me an email, mike@imhighperformance.
This copyrighted podcast is presented to you by Iron Mike Stone and the Authors on the Air Global Radio Network.